Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
We'd just been shown to our table, and the waiter was about to get some menus, when my travelling companion piped up with the first and only words of Italian I would hear her speak. Vino rosso pronto, per favore. It was clear that no menu would ever be looked at before a calming glass of house wine had been served. My companion and new best friend was the renowned journalist, civil rights campaigner and feminist, Nell McCafferty. We had been sent to Italy to cover Ireland's pivotal World Cup game against Romania for the Pat Kenny radio show. I knew Nell by reputation only, so when we met at Dublin Airport, I was a little taken aback to see that her luggage comprised two T-shirts, assorted underwear, and a toothbrush, which she carried in a squashed-up plastic shopping bag. "What more do I need?" she said. "Sure, we'll only be away for 2 days." Now, while a trip to Italy might appear to be a dishy assignment, the catch was that we'd been asked to travel at less than 24 hours' notice. We had no hotel bookings, no match tickets, no Italian lira, but I'd managed to find us rooms in a modest hotel about 30 kilometres south of Genoa. By the time we sat down in that friendly trattoria, we were both completely whacked out and famished. We'd been living on our wits since leaving Dublin that morning, but now at least we had a roof over our heads and a vague promise of tickets for the following day's match. Nell McCafferty and myself were unlikely candidates for this World Cup assignment. Admittedly, Nell knew a little about Derry City FC, whereas I only had a passing knowledge of any of the Irish soccer players. But in a way, that was the genius of sending us to cover the World Cup. We were like the majority of people in Ireland that summer, when the country got swept along on a tsunami of excitement and optimism in support of Jack Charlton and his boys in green. Monday, the 25th of June 1990, was a swelteringly hot day. Nell and I had breakfast and sipped strong espressos on a shady terrace overlooking the small fishing harbour of Camogli and considered our travel options. While trains, buses and taxi services were readily available, I felt our approach should be more in keeping with Genoa's maritime history. After all, it was the birthplace of Christopher Columbus. So, following an hour of my limited and very broken Italian, lots of hand-waving and gesticulations, as well as some serious haggling, I found a speedboat owner who was prepared to ferry us up the coast, about the same distance as Greystones to O'Connell Bridge. For more than an hour, we bounced over the azure-blue waves of the Mediterranean, cooled by a sea breeze and salt spray. Our water taxi delivered us into a luxury yacht marina, which was jam-packed with squillion-dollar pleasure boats, the likes of which you'd only ever see in James Bond movies. With our feet firmly back on dry land, we regained our equilibrium and discovered that it was just a short walk to the Stadio Luigi Ferraris, Genoa's equivalent of Croke Park. The concourse around the stadium was already heaving with thousands of Irish soccer fans. Jack Charlton's travelling army had won the hearts of the Italian people for their bonhomie, irrepressible singing and insanely optimistic ambitions for the tournament. Here, Nell's status as a national icon came into its own. As she mingled among the waiting fans, she was instantly recognised and very warmly greeted. Incredible stories of how some fans had abandoned jobs at home and raised credit union loans were shared with her as if she were a long-lost but much-loved family relative. There was the intrepid granny from Talla, who had joined her son and his mates as they drove a camper van from Dublin to Cagliari in Sardinia and then onwards to Palermo in Sicily before finally ending up in the stadium car park in Genoa. No, she wasn't interested in attending the match itself, she told us. She had washed the lads' clothes and hung them on a makeshift washing line because there was great drying out that day. The match itself is imprinted on our collective unconscious. Nil all after extra time, it went to a penalty shootout, which Ireland won 5-4 after a stunning arms outstretched save by Paddy Bonner and an ice-cool tap from David O'Leary into the back of the Romanian net. The stadium went Vesuvius, as did everyone back home. 90 minutes later, Nell and myself had inveigled ourselves onto the media bus, which was travelling in convoy to the Irish team's hotel. We walked nonchalantly, eyes always forward, into the dining room to join the team and their families for the post-match celebration. We bagged a couple of seats at one table, but our lack of football knowledge quickly became apparent, as it took me until dessert before I realised that we were deep in conversation with none other than Ronnie Whelan and his family. I wrote his name on the back of a napkin, which I slipped over to Nell. After dinner, we crowded around Big Jack and had photos taken with them. In those happy snaps, Jack Charlton bears his magnificent trademark smile. Much later, Nell and myself headed back into the centre of Genoa to commune with the hordes of delirious Irish supporters, many of whom were still cooling their jets in the medieval fountain of the Piazza di Ferrari long after midnight. Already, these fans' thoughts had turned to the Stadio Olimpico in Rome, where Ireland was due to face the host nation Italy 5 days later for a place in the World Cup semi-finals. At 4 a.m., I escorted Nell back to our hotel in Camogli, and I had her up again early and sitting in a radio studio talking to Pat Kenny about our journey to Genoa. What listeners heard from Nell was a fantastical tale, recounted in an almost Joycean stream of consciousness, a retelling of our matchday wanderings. She ended that broadcast with a plea for RTE bosses to send out more money and fresh knickers. And so we made our way on to Rome, where we managed to attend one of the team's training sessions. Chatting to Paddy Bonner, I was astonished to see just how lean and athletic he was, rippling with the energy of a racehorse. We also joined the team for a special audience with Pope John Paul II, after which I lost Nell for about an hour. She'd gone walkabout in some out-of-bounds part of the Vatican and was eventually escorted back out onto St. Peter's Square by the Swiss Guard. Our Italia 90 odyssey lasted more than a week, meeting Irish fans everywhere, hearing about their joyous adventures, and then sharing their tales with Pat Kenny and an entranced nation of radio listeners. And every evening, we would find an affordable trattoria and sink into our seats to take stock of our stories, and before ever looking at a menu, Nell would order a carafe of Vino Rosso Pronto, per favore.
There was this family at the table, a mother and father and two sons, and I started telling them about the match, you see, because I was well excited. And John wrote me a wee note across the table and said, "You're talking to Ronnie Whelan." And I just froze.
You were telling Ronnie Whelan about the match.
And then I froze, and over his shoulder I could see Jack Charlton, and I thought, if Jack Charlton knows I'm interfering with Ronnie Whelan, he's going to do a name and dump for Ronnie. I just said, if I say nothing, if I eat nothing, if I drink nothing, nobody will even notice I'm here. I was in heaven, Pat. But I wasn't able to talk. The Whelans are very nice. I ruined their party because they didn't know. I mean, there's this wee person sitting dead quiet opposite them. I was like a rabbit caught in headlights. I was in heaven, Pat.
And what?
I ate with the gods last night.
And did they behave like gods? I mean, were they delighted with themselves, or was it muted, or were they going every so often,
"Woo-hoo"? You see, I mean, the blood was pounding in my ears, you know. It was like watching a silent movie. I think they were a wee bit quiet. I mean, I saw Ronnie Whelan kiss his wife. I suppose if Jack Charlton hears I saw that, I'll get killed. They were like wee boys, you know. They're going to Italy last night. I mean, they're going to fight the Italians, and they just cannot wait. They can't get over themselves. Yeah. I mean, we're in the big time now.
My dad didn't have a clue, but I never blamed him. I must have been 12 and he was, what, about 45 or something. Ancient. By that time, a man couldn't remember what 12 was like. I tried sometimes to picture him as a child, to imagine his dreams and ambitions, but whatever youthful plans he'd once made, he'd ended up here, living above a pub in Fulham, with a 12-year-old to entertain every second Sunday. We tried museums for a couple of weeks, but the crowds got on his nerves. I was always fearful that all those chirpy families, poring over their guidebooks and thermos flasks, made him feel like he'd messed up. So when he suggested we give something else a go, I was more than happy. We went to the football, but I knew from the start his heart wasn't in that either. He was what today we would call old school. He respected the players as athletes and applauded the abolition of the maximum wage, but deep down inside he still felt that a player couldn't properly represent Huddersfield if he wasn't from Huddersfield, or Ipswich, or Tottenham, or Crystal Palace. We watched an uneventful cup tie between Fulham and someone, and as we went towards my train, he asked if next time we might try the pictures. Yes, I said. And we did. And for the next 2 years or so, that was it. He'd meet me at the station and we'd go to the cinema by way of his flat. Or, to be more precise, by way of the pub under his flat. I was too young to go inside, so he'd stand at the bar with a group of regulars and I'd sit outside drinking ginger beer and eating crisps. Even as it was happening, I realised that this was the epitome of poor parenting. But to be honest, I loved it. I could eat and drink my fill, read Sunday newspapers which my mother wouldn't have allowed through the letterbox, and watch grown-ups behaving like kids. The cinema was round the corner, and had clearly been chosen more because of its location than its repertoire. Hardly any of the films were in English. They were nearly all black and white, and the vast majority of them were, according to the man in the ticket booth, pre-war. He didn't say which war. My dad liked the films because they were quiet and slow, and after four or five pints, no man wants bright lights or excitement. And I liked the films because they were filled with philosophical thieves and actresses with expressive hands and coal-penciled eyes. If the film was dull or incomprehensible, and often they were, then I would leave him to doze. But sometimes a film would grab me and hold me tight from the start, and thinking that my father might enjoy it too, I'd launch into a routine of nudges and coughs, designed to give him a chance to wake up and watch it with me. And so on Monday mornings, as my classmates talked about Ice Station Zebra or Kelly's Heroes, I would fill them in on La Femme du Boulanger, Pepe Le Moko, or perhaps Louis Bunuel's Land Without Bread. Our lives had diverged long before he died. He was in some university town that I'd never visited, while I was in Ireland with a family of my own. But a few days after his passing, I saw that Bicycle Thieves was showing on TV. This was one of the films which I'd woken him to watch, and convinced as ever of Vittorio De Sica's genius, I grabbed my five-year-old, told him how I'd first seen this film with the grandfather he'd never meet, and convinced him to watch it with me. It opens with shots of war-torn Rome. A man too thin for his suit has got a job as a poster hanger, and we watch as his wife pawns her bedsheets to get him the bike he needs. It's a hard film. All the faces are hungry, and the sunlight is unforgiving. But when the man gets his bike, his smile is like rain in a desert. I looked across at the child, wondering whether he could be caught by the film as I had been almost 40 years before. He was, of course, already asleep.
Ballast. In all the photographs I come across, I am leaning into him, like an old wheel standing up against a wall. his arm draped around my shoulders. We often posed together like that. And I recall the solidity of him, the physicality of him. He was like ballast in a boat. He'd not stir. He was steady as she goes on that garden seat.
I was working on a book on Irish sculpture some years ago when a friend drew my attention to mention of a public monument in Randallstown in County Antrim. The monument was a war memorial. Nothing strange about that. What was strange, however, was that a representation of Mother Ireland was indicated. A statue of Erin in a town in County Antrim? This seemed somewhat incongruous to me, and so I was determined to see it. Heading north to Belfast for an exam board one day, I decided to drive first to Randallstown to see and photograph the sculpture. This was going to be fairly straightforward. After all, a piece of public sculpture should be immediately visible in a town. With some excitement, I drove into Randallstown, glancing left and right and centre, and before too long found myself on the other side of the town. I saw no Mother Ireland, no war memorial, no public monument, even. I pulled into the side of the road to consider what next. Perhaps I should just call it a day, consider it a fool's errand, and head back towards Belfast. But I really wanted to know if the statue had ever existed. I'd ask about it in the town, I thought. It was only then that I noticed the edges of the pavement decorated in the colours of the Union Jack. I hesitated. Did I really want to step out of my southern registered car to ask in my equally southern accent about a statue of Mother Ireland? Near the car, two older people with their dogs were chatting, so I thought I would brave it. I went over and introduced myself and my work and, tentatively, started to describe what I was seeking. "It's a war memorial with a figure of Mother Ireland on it," I said. They reflected and conferred and agreed that they'd no knowledge of such a statue. But they pointed to the graveyard across the road. "There's a section over there devoted to the war dead," they said. "It might be there. And if not, the man who works there might be able to help." I crossed the road. No sign of it among the war memorials in the cemetery, and the custodian didn't know anything about it either. He and I continued chatting as we walked back towards the entrance alongside a high boundary wall. He stopped briefly and said, "If you're interested in sculpture, there used to be a statue on the other side of that wall." "What kind of statue?" I asked. "A lady playing a harp," he said. My eureka moment. "That's it," I said. "That's the statue I'm looking for." It transpired that the building was a school and that the statue had been located in its courtyard, but it was removed during the Troubles because it would inevitably have been a target. "But where is it now?" I asked. He didn't know. I had found the statue only to lose it again. "Try the post office," he said. "There's a man who works there, something of a local historian. He might know more." Clearly, I wasn't done yet. Inside the post office, standing by a desk and separate from the ongoing business, a man was talking on the phone. Presuming this to be the local historian, I stood nearby waiting for him to finish. But he interrupted the call to ask how he could help. So I started my little speech with all the key words. "I am an art historian who specialises in Irish sculpture, Randallstown, War Memorial, Mother Ireland." He said nothing, just stared at me. Then he handed me the phone. "Say exactly what you have said to me, to the person at the other end," he instructed me. I became uneasy, beginning to think that this whole Mother Ireland thing was a mistake after all. But steeling myself, I started off again, this time into the phone. Art historian, Irish sculpture, Randallstown, War Memorial, Mother Ireland. There was silence at the other end of the phone. Silence, followed by a great burst of laughter, and I heard a woman's voice saying, "I'm standing beside it." She, the man's wife, in fact, was in the grounds of Shane's Castle, which is just outside the town on the shores of Loch Ney. I thanked her husband profusely and drove straight to the statue. The castle, which was burnt down during the War of Independence, is the former home of the O'Neill family. The second Baron, Edward O'Neill, and his wife Louisa commissioned the memorial for Randallstown in Paris in 1922 from the French sculptor Victor Segoffin. It commemorates their son Arthur, an Ulster Unionist MP who was killed during the war, and, as it says on the inscription, the men of the district who fell with him. O'Neill, who was the father of Terence O'Neill, Prime Minister of Northern Ireland and leader of the UUP, was the first Member of Parliament to be killed in the war. I found the statue positioned in the tiny family graveyard on the estate. There's something romantic about its setting, lonely and remote. And the statue itself depicts an image of unrestrained grief as the mourning figure of Erin, somewhat melodramatically, presents her unstrung harp. After taking lots of photos, I headed to Belfast, mission accomplished, and grateful to the people of Randallstown, who with so much kindness had helped me find the statue that their ancestors had rejected.
It was my dad who removed the stabilizers from my first bicycle and stored them carefully in the shed to be used later for my younger brother. He then set me up against the front garden wall to practice pushing myself off, and there he left me to get going on two wheels, and I have not stopped cycling since. Dad had the right tools to raise my saddle as my knees got in the way of my handlebars. He knew how to adjust and fix the brakes and the gears too. He had a toolbox for bicycle repair, a toolbox for carpentry, one for plumbing, one for electrics, another for painting and decorating, and a box containing old sweet tins, each one full of spare parts. He erected a shelf in the garage, and to the underside of it he screwed the metal lids of old jam jars. Each jar hung down from its lid, and at a glance anyone could see inside and find exactly what was needed. Screws, nails, rawl plugs, washers, nuts and bolts of graded sizings. It was an ingenious system that meant he knew exactly where to find each item, even in the midst of a crisis. It was to Dad I went when my bike chain was stuck, and I watched as he tugged it out of the gears and set me off again. Gloopy Swarfiga squelched through his hands under the running tap. The smell of it followed him around for the remainder of the day. And it was Dad who brought me to buy my first big racer bike with my confirmation money. He was horrified that my main criterion for choosing a bike was colour. I ignored his advice to get a rally and chose an unknown brand instead, because it was pale blue with an incandescent sparkle about it. I loved that bike. Dad was keen to pass on his skills and self-sufficiency to his children, so we spent many school evenings in the garage doing odd jobs. While the rest of the family were finishing homework or sneaking in some telly in his absence, I got lessons in, among other things, puncture repair. With his sports jacket hanging on the ironing board and his sleeves rolled up, he turned my bike upside down, always using a small rag under the saddle to prevent it from getting scuffed on the cement floor. Then he took the toolbox down and showed me step by step how to repair a puncture. I hunkered in close, fascinated by the swathes of thick hair on his forearms and the large veins that bobbed under his skin as he worked. His hands were square and sensible, hands to make things work. First he removed the tire and released the tube. Then he got a basin of water, and in a comfortable silence we waited until we saw a stream of tiny bubbles emerge from the tire, a hiss confirming what we were seeing. He didn't stop then. There could have been a pinch or a second puncture, so we continued on until the entire tube was examined. He then showed me how to roughen the tube surface, apply the glue and patch, and wait before reinserting the tube back into the tire. All the while I acted like the theatre nurse to his surgeon, passing him his various tools as the job progressed. When the puncture was repaired, he lifted my bike back onto its two wheels, as though it was an overturned box of cereal on the breakfast table. I watched in anticipation as he pumped the wheel. A gentle sense of satisfaction for a job well done lingered about him. He never failed. Needless to say, I didn't manage to do this without him. I started the process once, but called him out from behind his newspaper where he was relaxing, smoking his pipe. He took over and we resumed our easy roles of surgeon and assistant. As cruel ageing took hold of him, he no longer tinkered with bicycles. Leaks appeared and hinges came loose. His toolboxes became chaotic, an indicator, if one was needed, of his internal distress. Fortunately for me, I did pay attention to some of his lessons. So I can put up a shelf, change a plug, and paint a room without splashing anywhere. But my bicycle, with its newfangled braking system and multiple gears, has me confounded. Dad died 2 months ago, early in the COVID crisis, and now I find myself thinking about endings and beginnings and the cycle of life. I have to believe that there is no end, that he lives on in me and my square hands and DIY skills, amongst other things. I will endeavour to pass these on to my children too, so that the cycle goes on. And each time I get on my bicycle, I will find comfort in knowing that it was he who started me out on the bike, he who kept me going on it for many years, and he who gave me the gifts of freedom, health and happiness that I get as I view life from over the handlebars.
Yesterday, a child came out to wonder. Caught a dragonfly inside a jar. Fearful when the sky was full.
Only son. How strange to learn you kept an eye on my unpredictable journey. Were the cuttings stored safely away, or kept a hand in the living room beside TV and fire? Staged photographs from the West, or anonymous backdrops, your only son, awkward as ever before the camera. I have one in return of you, looking the very best, hands in embrace, the sunlit beaming face.
The writing this morning included Vino Rosso Pronto, Per Favore by John Egan, Father's Day by Chris McCallum, Ballast, a poem by Catherine Foley, Randallstown War Memorial, Mother Ireland was by Paula Murphy, Life from Over the Handlebars by Sheila Maher, and Only Son, a poem by Gerald Daw. The music was Nessun Dorma, sung by Pavarotti, and before that an excerpt of Nell McCafferty's Italian 90 reporting on The Pat Kenny Show. The Bicycle Thieves theme by Alessandro Cicconini. The Sea of Love, played on guitar by John Fahey. Silent O'Moyle, played by Joanne Quigley on violin, with David Quigley on piano. And lastly, The Circle Game by Joni Mitchell. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey, and the producer is Sarah Binchy. RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.